State lawmakers just passed a state budget worth $82.3 billion, and Governor Scott answered with $256 million in vetoes. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
From the Donna Studio at WSF Public Media, I'm Carson Cooper. Let's say hello to our guest, veteran political reporter William Wendy March, has been covering the session for the Associated Press. Welcome back to Florida Matters.
Hey, Carson. Glad to be here.
Aubrey Jewett, political science professor at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, coming to us from the studios of WMFE in Orlando. Great to have you here, Aubrey.
Well, wonderful to be here.
So, Wendy March, Governor Scott was quick to call this a very good session. That's what his words were as he declared a legislative victory. Though you have to wonder, though, lawmakers did not deliver his tax cuts or the $250 million he wanted for economic incentives aimed at luring employers to Florida. Was this a good session for Scott?
Not really. The lawmakers pretty much trashed the priorities that he set out at the outset. $1 billion in tax cuts, plus the $250 million for economic incentives. They also, another kind of a thumb in the eye, failed to approve his Surgeon General for confirmation, which means that Scott has now had to replace his Surgeon General.
Mm-hmm. And as far as tax cuts, $129 million worth, far from that $1 billion he wanted.
Yeah, I think it depends on how you count it. But yes, they totally failed to go along to meet his priority on that.
Back to school shoppers will get a tax holiday this year in August, 3 days worth. I want to talk more about Scott's vetoes in a moment, but $256 million is not really a huge amount of vetoes. It's about half of what last year was. What's the overall message coming from Scott through his veto pen this year?
Well, it was comparatively conciliatory, at least compared to last year, as you just mentioned, and several lawmakers, including our own Tom Lee of Brandon, who was the budget chairman in the Senate this year, have reacted very mildly, saying that Scott did nothing bad in their view. Not only was it half of what last year's veto total was, but part of it, $50 million of it, was a single item, and that was where the legislature swept money out of a trust fund to be used for economic development and took that money to use for the general ongoing budget. That was one of, and if you subtract that from Scott's veto list, it's down to about $200 million instead of $256.
Aubrey Jewett, lawmakers approved a bump in K-12 funding, $458 million, but that money will come from general revenue and not, as the governor wanted, from local property taxes. And in fact, they called that line item in the budget, in big bold letters, local property tax relief, almost daring the governor to veto that.
Absolutely. You can tell sometimes when it's an election year, and and this is one of them. And particularly in the Senate, you know, because of the redistricting, all the senators who are trying to get reelected are going to be up, all 40. Normally it'd just be 20. So I think that played into it as well. But I think it's a good deal for taxpayers across the state, because what the governor had proposed was going to basically say, we're going to increase education spending, and we're going to pretend that we're cutting taxes by a large amount, where in fact what his proposal did was say, well, really, we'll increase spending and put it on the back of property taxpayers. And now that's not the case. Instead, the legislature found ways to pay it out of the general revenue, and property taxes won't go up just to pay for it.
Well, with all this legislative sausage making aside, what does this mean for the average homeowner as far as taxes go?
Well, it should mean that they don't see a big increase in their property tax bill. Now, of course, they still may see mild increases, but they won't see a large increase, at least not because of the state-mandated increase for education anyway.
Wendy March, tax transparency failed. That would have required school districts to use the term tax increase in ads telling taxpayers about annual property tax increases.
Yes. The idea of this is to to show, of course, property taxes depend on two different things. One is the value of your property, and one is the rate. Your value can go up, and then your taxes will go up, even if your rate stays the same. There are some laws in Florida that apply to various kinds of property taxes that require it to be described as a tax increase if the rate stays the same, but you pay more because your value goes up.
Mm-hmm. I want to ask you about Enterprise Florida. This has been very interesting to me this year. Governor Scott wanted $250 million for Enterprise Florida, which would lure, it's a program aimed at luring businesses to Florida. Clearwater Senator Jack Latvala said the state has not been getting its money's worth from Enterprise Florida.
Yes, but Latvala was also one of the senators who wanted to go ahead and fund Scott's request for that $250 million. That was stopped mainly by the House and by our own Richard Corcoran, who was the budget chief in the House this year.
Aubrey Jewett, Naples Senator Garrett Richter, who is term limited, says he was disappointed that his chamber rejected Enterprise Florida funding, as did the House, as Wendy just pointed out. But he hopes it'll come back next year. Florida is leading the nation right now in job creation, if not through economic incentives. Where is the growth in jobs coming from?
Well, I think some of it is just the natural growth that's occurring because we're coming out of the recession. But I think Florida continues to have some good things going for it when it comes to attracting businesses besides direct incentives. Our overall tax burden is fairly low. Of course, the weather is beautiful. Our education system is not considered, you know, top of the line if you compare it to the other 50 states, but it's considered good and it's considered improving by a lot of measures. And so I think there's just been a natural increase in business. And you don't necessarily need the direct incentives all the time. But I would say this, most people, obviously in the legislature, didn't like the way the Enterprise Florida was spending the money, didn't think they were getting a good return. And most people in principle don't like the idea. Democrats think it's sort of corporate welfare. Republicans think it's sort of a waste, picking winners and losers and that sort of thing. But the bottom line is that's the way the game is played all across the country at the state level and at the local level. And I wouldn't be surprised if they at least fund some money next year, because if you don't have any money to offer as incentives, you really do miss out sometimes on some deals that might help the state. Philosophically, I'm against it too. But
Winnie March, the governor, was saying the fund was almost dry. Was he overstating that? Many lawmakers thought, hey, there's plenty of money in there you're not telling us about.
Well, again, Carson, it depends on how you count it. There's money that's been committed but not actually spent. And based on that, Scott says it's dry, whereas lawmakers say they haven't spent the money we've already given them.
Mm-hmm. There were other major defeats for Scott. Lawmakers struck down two gun bills, guns on campus, and that open carry proposal. Both passed the House. Why did the Senate, in particular the Senate Judiciary Committee, not even hear those bills?
Well, that was a decision by leadership. Some attribute it to the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Miguel Diaz de la Portilla. Others attribute it to the Senate president himself, President Andy Gardner. But in any case, one way or another, the Judiciary Committee has stopped these bills 2 years in a row now. One is allowing guns to be carried on university and college campuses in Florida, and the other was open carry.
Right.
Those bills almost certainly will be back. Gardner and Diaz de la Portillo probably won't be in his position next year. So those bills will come back and the NRA will keep pushing for them. We'll see what happens in the future.
Now, guns on campus would not have just allowed it. It would have allowed universities to make up their own mind about that. Is that right?
No, it's not.
It
would have required universities to allow guns on campus to be carried by individuals who have concealed carry permits.
Oh, I see.
Which
okay.
means that they would have to be 21 years old, have a concealed carry permit, and if they did, they could then carry a firearm on campus.
Yeah.
The universities are ardently and unanimously opposed to it, and one of the chief opponents is John Thrasher, the president of FSU, who is a good friend, a close associate of the Senate president, Andy Gardner.
Aubrey Jewett, lawmakers did approve a measure that protects gun owners when they pull the trigger in self-defense, although they did not shift the burden of proof in such cases from defense to prosecution.
Yeah, I thought that showed some common sense, which sometimes, as Wendy and as you know, Carson, is in short supply in the legislature. You know, the original thing they were looking at. I mean, really, it was just going to turn the judicial system on their head and let people shoot and say, well, you know, hey, you can't do anything about it. But now I think this is a little more. Just makes more sense. The bottom line is, somebody, if they pull out a gun and fire a warning shot or inadvertently shoot, and as long as they don't actually hit somebody and kill them or hurt them, then, you know, they don't necessarily get charged with a felony right off the bat. So,
Before we get completely away from the budget, Carson, we probably, one of the most important things that we ought to mention is the level of education funding. It has gone up. But by less than inflation, if you measure it the most accurate way, which is per pupil spending, it's gone up about 1%. That's a good deal less than Rick Scott wanted and is another significant loss for him out of this session. Mm-hmm. But as Aubrey mentioned a few moments ago, the way Scott wanted to do that was by forcing local property taxpayers to pay the tab for that. The legislature rejected that idea.
The Seminole Indian Tribe lobbied hard for approval of a new $3 billion gambling compact that seemed closely linked to an expansion of gambling, an idea that the Senate absolutely hates. Did one bill bring down the other? I mean, how closely tied are those?
Well, the enacting the compact required a bill that would have significantly expanded gambling. And whenever you have a gambling issue come up in the legislature, one legislature described it as something like throwing a standing rib roast into a swimming pool full of sharks. You have so many vested interests with a lot of money at stake, the Seminoles themselves, the gambling interest, the pari-mutuels. And then you have, of course, a lot of legislatures who are opposed to any expansion of gambling. Now, Scott negotiated a new compact with the Seminole tribe, which would have allowed them to continue legally the gambling operations that they have and would have expanded gambling in various ways in the state, allowing slot machines in some new counties. And that bill died at the end of the session, as they were unable to come to an agreement among all these various vested interests that I described.
But in principle, do you think the House and Senate was generally in favor of the compact itself, the $3 billion that would have come into the state? The previous compact that Governor Crist signed was worth, what was it, $100 million?
That's right. And these numbers are spread over periods of years, so they're not money all at once.
5 years for that compact,
right.
$3 billion, significantly more than the last compact. So.
Well, I think there are some legislators, a fairly sizable contingent, who are opposed to any kind of expansion of gambling at all. And that's just one of the considerations that are in the mix whenever you try to get a bill this big and this complex concerning gambling through the legislature.
And so no chance that lawmakers might come back for a special session. I mean, if the Senate doesn't want to do it, they're not going to do it in a special session or anything, right?
I think a special session in this election year is extremely unlikely.
Yeah.
For any reason.
I do think it'll come back. And I think eventually it will probably pass, but it will only pass when the legislators face the possibility that the Seminole tribe is going to continue gambling and continue with slot machines, continue with blackjack, and the state's not going to get any money. And if there's a court battle going on. Both sides have filed lawsuits against each other. But I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me that based on what's happened in many other states, the Seminoles have a pretty good leg to stand on. Bottom line is, when the Seminoles decide that they're going to keep doing this and the legislature realizes, oh my gosh, we're not going to get any money, and they're still going to gamble anyway, then I think that puts more pressure on them to actually come to agreement.
I want to talk about a few more things that passed and failed. Aubrey Jewett, I'm sure everyone is relieved that it will be legal to shack up with someone in Florida after lawmakers rejected the 1868 law that could send you to jail for that crime. By the way, I thought that was just some antiquated law, but evidently folks have been prosecuted in recent years because of this.
Yeah, occasionally it does happen. Of course, a lot of my college students were very thrilled to hear that they could no longer be arrested if they were living with their boyfriend or girlfriend. But the other thing that I thought was interesting, it was one of the very few areas of law in Florida that actually gave the LGBT community a leg up, because the bill very specifically only applied to a male and female living together and being lascivious or something like that. So same-sex couples actually were a little more protected under there. But nonetheless, they've removed that old statute that's been around for 140 years.
Well, your students may be relieved about that, but they still have to answer to mom and dad back home.
Well, yeah, there is that.
Alimony reform.
Yeah.
This created quite a bit of debates in the legislature.
Well, it was a bitter and emotionally divisive debate. At times, people were comparing it to Jerry Springer's show. The bill ends permanent alimony awards in Florida. Instead, it would determine the amount of alimony paid and the length of time of the payments based on a formula that includes the length of the marriage and the difference in income between the two spouses. Now, what you had in one committee hearing on this bill after another in the legislature was a parade of people, alimony recipients, usually women but not always women, saying that they've been left in poverty by well-to-do former husbands who are able to get out of paying alimony in court. Mm. But then you also had a number of alimony payers who say that they're unfairly and unjustly ordered to spend a substantial portion of their income supporting a former spouse who chooses not to work, refuses to work. This is the fifth year that people in the legislature have tried to pass this reform bill. One version of it was vetoed by Scott a couple of years ago, because it would have been retroactive. It would have applied to awards made previously. This bill is not retroactive, according to its sponsors. So the question is, will Scott sign it?
Does this just give judges greater leeway when decisions are made, or does it force judges to...
It doesn't force the judges, but it gives them guidelines. And the backers of this bill say that what this will do is it will give people some predictability, some consistency as to what they're likely to get when they go to court. And they say that will eliminate litigation driven by anger and a desire for revenge.
Coming up,
it's got a certain populist appeal. Almost everybody who went to school in the last 60 years remembers going to recess in elementary school and remembers it fondly as probably the highlight of the day.
More on what passed and failed, and a look at some of Governor Scott's vetoes when we continue. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the session. How might this particular budget affect you? Let's hear it. You can weigh in on our Facebook page or at WUSFnews.org. Click on the Florida Matters link. I'm Kirsten Cooper. This is Florida Matters. This is Florida Matters. I'm Kirsten Cooper. State lawmakers figure it will cost $82.3 billion to run the state in the coming fiscal year. Governor Scott is figuring on a little less. We're taking a look at this year's legislative session with veteran political reporter William Wendy March, who covered the session for the Associated Press, and Aubrey Jewett, political science professor at the University of Central Florida. Wendy, lawmakers included $1 billion for the DCF to spend on mental health and substance abuse treatment services, and $10.7 million to help reduce the backlog of untested rape test kits used by law enforcement and prosecutors.
Right. The rape test kits was a big issue because of news coverage of a huge backlog of, I think, some 10,000 of them. And preliminary tests have showed that actually clearing that backlog and testing those kits in a significant number of cases have produced links to other rape cases, which is the whole point of or one of the main points of doing the test kit to begin with.
Now, to explain what the kits do, and they've already been tested, they will identify through DNA possible suspects, and they have been tested, but I mean, they have been used, but not tested by crime labs.
Not tested for matches to other crimes.
Mm-hmm. Aubrey Jewett, most everyone seemed to agree both those measures had to pass, including that $1 billion for the DCF on mental health services.
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of those things that when you rank Florida against other states, unfortunately, frequently we're at the bottom of things that you'd want the Florida to be, want the state to be good at, and we're ranked high on things that you wouldn't want to be ranked high. And when it comes to mental health funding and services for the disabled and mentally ill, Florida's almost always at the bottom. And this won't leap us to the top of the other states, but at least it's a big step in the right direction.
Wendy March, I want to swing back to education just for a moment. Palm Harbor Republican Chris Sprouls was behind a measure to allow parents to be able to choose any public school for their kids that they wanted, as long as the campus could accommodate them. Some local school boards pushed back, saying that it'll screw up their construction plans, how they spend money, and kind of dilute the value of local school taxes.
Right. That was part of a major education bill, a train, so to speak. They call it a train because every legislator comes in and attaches another amendment to it, another car in the train. And a lot of it, a lot of the cars in this train were aimed at what legislators call school choice, and what many public school advocates say is helping charter schools at the expense of public schools.
And speaking of charter schools, a change in how their construction is funded.
I think what it does is expand the amount of capital funding that charter schools can receive from the state. Or even more basically, it just says taxpayer dollars are going to go to build charter schools. When they first were opening, originally, say, go back a decade or more, often they would just rent space in a very inexpensive, empty shopping center, you know, where an abandoned Walmart was or something like that, and do it on the cheap. But more and more, these charter schools are actually getting taxpayer dollars and building brick and mortar buildings, and the taxpayers are funding them.
And Aubrey Jewett, what about recess for those little kids? The requirement for 20 minutes of play, free play at elementary schools, that failed. A number of parents in Central Florida were kind of behind this idea, pushing lawmakers for more downtime for their kids.
Absolutely. And I think that's certainly a bill that's going to come back. It's got a certain populist appeal. Almost everybody who went to school in the last, 60 years remembers going to recess in elementary school and remembers it fondly as probably the highlight of the day. And the thought is, especially with all the pressure that's put on elementary school kids today with standardized testing and the FSAs and all that kind of thing, kids need a break. And as a parent of four kids, I can say all my kids definitely needed a break. And I was lucky enough that the elementary schools that my kids went to almost always had recess. So, again, I'm for this, and I hope it comes back up, and perhaps the legislator will rethink it. I don't think it was because they were opposed to recess per se, but once again, they were sort of, it's always that delicate balance of, where should we preempt the local schools and the school districts and have a statewide law, or where should we allow them to make up their own mind?
Yeah, it was about local choice. It was about local choice. They didn't want everything coming down from Tallahassee.
I think another interesting issue was Uber, and that affects a lot of people. There was a bill that would have prohibited local governments from stopping Uber from operating or for passing more regulations on Uber, but that failed. And so currently we're going to see a lot of battles, as we've been seeing the last year or two, at the local level between city councils and county commissions and Uber over what can be done and what can't be done, because there's not a statewide regulation yet, and so there's not a prohibition on it yet either.
So this leaves these ride-sharing services operating in a legal gray area. Some drivers in parts of the state have been cited for driving, others not. So, thanks for clearing that up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Basically, Uber has been very popular. Obviously, if they weren't popular, they wouldn't be able to stay in business. But a lot of people seem to like them. I've never used them, but a lot of people seem to like them, and they seem to offer a less expensive alternative. But the opponents say, hey, they're not playing by the same rules as the taxi companies. They don't have to follow the same regulations. They don't have to carry the same amount of insurance if something goes wrong. They don't have the same level of background checks for the drivers. So there's a lot of unfair competition from the eyes of the established taxi companies that have to do all those things.
Hillsborough County is ground zero for that. Here in Hillsborough County, Uber and Lyft drivers can actually be cited and fined $900 for practicing, you know, their job.
Vetoes. Let's get back to some of those Governor Scott's vetoes. He announced those before the ink was dry on the budget. Why so quickly?
Well, he announced it before the legislature had actually sent him the budget.
Yeah.
In other words, the budget was not on his table yet. It was sort of a preemptive strike in a way by Scott, but it was not as hard a hit as legislators might have expected, and as a lot of them did expect. There was a lot of talk during the session about how much Scott might veto, and even talk about coming back in a special session, something legislators hate to do, in order to potentially override some of his vetoes if he went, in their opinion, too far. They feared that because they had trashed a lot of his priorities, he would take revenge by trashing theirs. Scott's actual vetoes were a pretty mild response.
And you pointed out off mic that they don't seem to be directed at any one lawmaker or any...
Well, not really. You can make the argument. As I mentioned, Richard Corcoran, the House budget chief, was one of the leading opponents of Scott's, of the $250 million that Scott wanted for economic incentives. And a couple of pretty big priorities of his got caught in the veto net, including $11 million for a performing arts center at Pasco Hernando Community College. Mm-hmm. So you can draw some of those links, if you want to, between people who did things Scott didn't like and Scott vetoing certain of their priorities.
Wendy March, you mentioned Pasco Hernando's Performing Arts Center veto, $11 million. Other Bay Area vetoes, $100,000 for Hillsborough Healthy Start, $500,000 for the Hillsborough County Fair. Anything else notable in the Bay Area?
Well, probably there's some technology needs for the Hillsborough school system, a couple of other smaller things, including, I think, a cybersecurity program at USF. These are all small items. The big thing, as far as Tampa is concerned, is what was not vetoed: the $22.5 million to move the USF Medical School downtown is safe. One of the bigger items, I guess, that did get vetoed was $3 million for Hillsborough Community College South County campus.
Veteran political reporter William Wendy March and Aubrey Jewett, political science professor at the University of Central Florida in Orlando, thank you so much for joining me today.
Glad to be here, Carson.
Great to be on.
And that is it for today's show. And again, we really love hearing from you, especially when it comes to politics and the folks who are running your state. You can weigh in on Facebook or at WUSFnews.org and click on the Florida Matters link. Our show is produced by Lottie Watts, engineered by Craig George, and is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.